From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today, President Trump is expected to unveil his plan for a new coronavirus task force responsible for deciding when and how to reopen the country. Yesterday, he said he had absolute authority over that decision, but many state governors disagree.
In fact, governors in the Northeast and on the West Coast have formed pacts to coordinate regional plans to restart the economy on their own terms. Oregon, Washington, and California are working together in the West. New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts have joined forces on the East Coast. And joining us now is Democratic Governor John Carney of the state of Delaware. Governor, welcome.
It's good to be with you, Jeremy. Thank you.
Well, and before we get to this regional approach, let me just first ask you what the situation is like in Delaware with regard to coronavirus today. Have you already reached your peak of cases?
So last week, I told on our conference call with the hospitals and with local leaders across our state that we were looking at two really difficult weeks ahead, as we expected the number of positive cases and hospitalizations to increase to a peak. As it turns out, over the last 4 days, the number of hospitalizations has flattened out. Our positive cases continue to rise, though the median age of those cases is lowering, which is a good thing in the sense that the population most at risk are senior citizens and those with existing health conditions. So we've seen some good news over the last 4 days, and of course, nationally, we're seeing this conversation about recovery and reopening. Here in Delaware, we're still in an emergency order to stay at home, to shelter in place. When you have to go out for essential business, to do so and with appropriate personal hygiene and social distancing. So it's a challenging messaging for me as governor and for our team. But we're very pleased to join this coalition to think about the days ahead.
Well, and why did you decide to do that, to take this regional approach and work with the other states to reopen the economy together?
Yeah, so I think two things primarily. One is I wanted to learn from the experience of other states. The expectation is that Metro New York, Greater New York City in particular, as I watched Governor Cuomo's press conference over the weekend, they've seen their peak on the other side, and it's likely or possible that they may be in a position to start turning the lights on before we do. And I'd like to know the science around that decision making, what's guiding his decisions there clearly. So that's one reason to learn from others in our region. We've got some really smart people, very thoughtful governors led by Governor Cuomo, who's put the group together. And from Governor Baker in Massachusetts on the northern end to me in Delaware here on the southern end. So just a great group. We've been communicating. I've been communicating with Governor Murphy and Governor Wolf in particular and Governor Hogan in Maryland over the last month. And we've tried to be cognizant of decisions that each of us are making as a small state that is connected to these other states with I-95 and the Amtrak Northeast Corridor. We have a lot of a very porous border, if you will, and people coming from other states. And so if they close down an activity and we leave it open, we see an influx of people from Maryland and Pennsylvania, if that's what the case. So it's important to know what they're doing, when they're doing it, and to try to do it cooperatively or in a coordinated way if we can. But
what do you say to President Trump, though, who pushed back on governors taking these steps in that briefing with reporters last night? He said he has total authority. Let's listen.
The president of the United States has the authority to do what the president has the authority to do, which is very powerful. The president of the United States calls the shots.
Governor, what is your response to the president saying he has total authority about when the states will reopen?
Right. I just don't think that's the case. Each of the governors that are in our Northeast Mid-Atlantic coalition made the decisions to shut down our economies, to kind of lock down folks and ask our residents, command our residents to shelter in place.
And we should be the ones that open it back up based on the situation in the ground. I'm sure that I know a lot more about what's happening on the ground here in Delaware than the task force in Washington, D.C., the president and vice president. And so we'll use the expertise that the federal government has with CDC and NIH, and that'll drive and guide our decision-making. But we'll make the decisions here on the emergency orders, which we put in place initially. They were not put in place by the president or the federal authorities. We talk all the time on our White House calls about the way this is supposed to work, a response to an emergency. It is executed at the local level, it's managed at the state level, and it's supported at the federal level. And Vice President Pence says that just about on every call that we have. Mm. Supported at the federal level means providing the equipment and the resources we need to implement and manage the emergency here at the state level, and it's the governor's responsibility to put in place state of emergency and to take portions of that state of emergency declaration down when the situation on the ground allows it.
That is Governor John Carney of Delaware. Governor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, also in that task force briefing yesterday, reporters asked the president if he was firing Anthony Fauci because Trump retweeted a Trump supporter who said, "Time to fire Fauci." The president said, yes, he saw that hashtag, fire Fauci. But no, he wasn't thinking of that. It was just someone's opinion. But it added to concerns that Trump and his new task force may not listen to top doctors like Fauci when it comes to considering reopening the economy. Let's bring in NPR political correspondent Scott Detrow. Hi, Scott.
Hey there.
And Scott, yesterday Fauci also seemed to walk back a little his comments about how it might have been better if the administration had responded sooner to the outbreak. But still, is there concern that Anthony Fauci might be sidelined from this new task force or these considerations?
Well, Fauci pointed out he didn't quite walk back his comments. It was interesting. He said that some things that he said on a weekend Sunday show had been taken out of context, but then repeated essentially the same point that if mitigation had begun sooner, more lives would have been saved. The virus would have been more contained. Fauci did point out, though, that every time he has made a specific recommendation to President Trump, that initial social distancing guideline and then extending it through the end of April, he says the president has listened. Of course, as we've seen on President Trump's Twitter feed and at these briefings, there's lots of drama in between those decision points of will the president, you know, walk back this social distancing guideline? What will happen next? But Fauci says ultimately, in the end, he continues to feel listened to. And he made a point of saying when he was asked, no, I was not pressured to make any of the statements I made today.
Well, these daily task force briefings have, you know, been kind of de facto campaign moments for the president for a while. But yesterday seemed different. It was started by a campaign style video that Trump said his staff made. This would of course, be at taxpayer expense, touting the administration. He seemed angrier to many people, more defensive. Remind us the context, maybe why this tone.
Yeah, this came after, there have been steady reports all along, but over a weekend where there were several reports from the New York Times in particular that President Trump seemed to take notice of, really big picture look backs at how many times the administration did not act in the early weeks of January and February as the coronavirus was spreading around the globe. And as there was increasing concern about what would happen in the United States on testing in particular, getting testing ready and at a mass scale that still is not quite there yet. President Trump is increasingly focusing these briefings not on what's coming next, not on the trend lines or the plans, but looking back on the first few months and making the argument that his administration did everything right, as he puts it. Yeah. Yesterday, he again repeated this argument that he thinks he did nothing wrong at all. There were no mistakes made. Of course, many reports suggest otherwise, and many governors continue to be frustrated with the federal response and a lack of a coordination.
Yeah, and talk about the pandemic council being announced today. What do we know about who might be on it?
Yeah, who will actually be on the council continues to shift. We heard some things from the White House that the president then kind of contradicted already. So I think it's very Unclear who exactly will be on this council. Indications are that it'll be a mix of administration advisors and outside advisors, a mix of people from the economic community, some health professionals as well. The basic idea is to put together some sort of plan to get the country reopened at some point down the line. Now, President Trump increasingly sounds impatient again to do this sooner rather than later. But governors, especially governors on the East Coast and West Coast who have faced the highest numbers of infections, are saying they want to let the data drive that decision. They don't want to rush it. But this comes as you're seeing countries all around the world start to figure out how to get society back and moving again, which will have to happen at some point.
And just in the seconds we have, in the midst of all this today, former President Obama endorsed Joe Biden, his former vice president. Is that going to cut through any of this?
Well, Biden, I'm sure, wishes it would have been at a big rally, the type of thing that Obama specializes in. But Obama purposely did not endorse any Democratic candidates throughout the process because he wanted to unite the party behind the eventual nominee, who looks to be the man who he served with for 8 years, Joe Biden.
Yeah. NPR political correspondent Scott Detrow, thank you.
Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The majority of patients who go on a ventilator for COVID-19 do not survive, according to several small studies from China, the U.S., Europe. Even for patients who do make it, ventilators can cause long-lasting damage to the lungs. Well, thankfully, we've not yet seen the dire shortages of ventilators that were predicted. But what if you already knew, man, I never want to be on a ventilator, and then you got sick? And a hospital had to choose between you and a young mother who desperately did want a ventilator, and you couldn't speak for yourself, and you hadn't told anyone else to speak for you. Yes, we're having another conversation about advanced healthcare directives, this time in the time of COVID-19. Dr. Louise Aronson is a geriatrician at the University of California, San Francisco, the author of Elderhood, Redefining Aging, Transforming Medicine, Reimagining Life. So, Louise, what is an advanced healthcare directive?
Well, it's a broad term for any piece of paper or even video in these days where you make explicit what you would want and what you would not want in the case of grave illness or if you are dying. And there are two key parts. One is choosing someone who can decide for you if you're unable to speak for yourself. And the second part is making sure that person, and ideally your healthcare providers, which is why we write these things down, know what you want, what you don't want, what you value in your life, and what really terrifies you and you'd like to avoid.
And does it have to be, you know, one of these legal documents or you on camera? Can it just be you telling a friend?
Well, you can't just tell a random friend. So if you tell a friend, what you then need is a document that says that friend is your durable power of attorney for healthcare. That is the person who can decide for me. And that's important because sometimes the person we're closest to is the one we want to decide. And sometimes you actually want to spare that person a moral dilemma, right? Because they love you so much, they might want to try to extend your life even when it's hopeless and it might be painful for you, just out of love, not out of ill will. And there might be someone else who can just sort of be rational and do what you would want and be your voice in that really hard situation.
Well, I think that's what's the key word there is what you want. Somebody who adores you may know what you want and just not be able to carry it out. And this is important at any time. But it just seems so much more important now when resources might be scarce.
It's very true, but I actually think it's a little more complicated than scarce resources because we're having a lot of conversations about, oh, there might not be enough ventilators. But I think the more important thing to know is that if you are a certain sort of person, if you are a person who is very old or has advanced cancer or is just a bit old but has bad heart disease or lung disease, your chances of survival if you need intensive care with a ventilator are really poor. So we don't have all the data we need now, but looking at what we know so far from the U.S., what we know from Italy, what we know from China and South Korea, that 50 to 90% of people die. And let me also be clear that the 10 to possibly 50, though we doubt it, percent of people who are alive, because people are on ventilators for so long, we don't mean you're alive and back to your life. We mean you're alive and in the hospital and still in extremis in almost all cases.
So let me be clear. You are talking specifically about much older people or older people who have compromised health or even slightly younger people who have things like heart disease. You're saying of that population, those who are sick enough with COVID-19 to need a ventilator, 50 to 90% of them will not survive. And that, you know, you say that so that what we can take this in when we make this decision as to whether or not we want that.
Absolutely. Because if your chances are really, really poor, and if you are 80 plus and have any other diseases, your chances are very poor, then what you might want to decide is, hey, I want to go to the hospital and I want the antivirals and I want you to give me oxygen. And even there's an intermediate thing called positive pressure ventilation where a mask helps you breathe. But if I am so gravely ill that I require mechanical ventilation, and we all know that my chances of survival are really poor, and that survival, if I make it through, is going to look really different than my life now, I'm okay with you focusing on my comfort. Let me die comfortably and naturally and not with tubes down everywhere or suffering if it's not going to help me.
Well, and I'm just going to jump in to say there are incredibly vibrant 75, 80-year-olds for whom a ventilator might be the perfect decision. And, you know, we're not here encouraging people, you know, what the decision is, but to explain what some of the considerations are. So, yes, go for it. If that should be in your directive as well. In other words, you're saying your directive can say, I want that.
Exactly. So you can direct either way. But when we talk about rationing, we sort of take the human being and his or her wishes out of it and the medical knowledge of your specific illness. And so I'm saying let's let those things inform it. You're absolutely right about, I mean, Anthony Fauci, who's been front and center, is 79 years old, right? Mm-hmm. We're very clearly not saying that if you have a chance, let's give up just because you're old. I'm a geriatrician. That's the last thing I would ever say. What I'm saying is if you have no chance, let's let that be your decision. And there are all kinds of groups out there that have put really good decision-making guides onto the web for people, and ones where you can make the global decisions we talk about with advanced care planning, but you can also think just specifically about COVID. If that's the easiest thing for you to do now, that one little step is really helpful for you and your family should you become ill.
We'll link people up at herenow.org. Louise Aronson, geriatrician at the University of California, San Francisco, author of the book Elderhood. Louise, Dr. Aronson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, pivoting now to a challenge for parents. With most schools closed, many for the rest of the year, we've been hearing how to keep kids busy. What about citizen science? Andy Daniel-Cubis of the Allegheny Front explains.
Jeannie McHale is self-isolating in her house in Pittsburgh with her husband, four kids, and a dog. There's baking to be done and some schoolwork, but there's also figuring out whether that antelope-sized animal with stripes and a horn is a bush buck or a yellow-backed duiker.
I think it looks like it.
Oh, yeah, he does kind of have that stripey thing down, doesn't he? And he's big.
He's definitely big.
Big.
Jeannie and 7-year-old Freda aren't playing some fun computer game. They're helping real scientists classify data collected from cameras in Africa.
And what behaviors are we seeing?
I think it's like moving through the grass.
Mm-hmm.
For this project, Wild Gabon, researchers are trying to figure out how important the edges of ecosystems are to a national park in the West African country. The project is housed on the website Zooniverse, the largest citizen science platform in the world. Projects are arranged by topic, from space to ecology to climate to medicine. There are nearly 100 to choose from.
Researchers truly would not be able to do this on their own.
This is Laura Trulli. She's Vice President of Citizen Science at the Adler Planetarium in Chicago and the co-leader for Zooniverse.
They have huge data sets, like a million galaxies to tag or hundreds of thousands of tuberculosis samples to test against different antibiotics. Crowdsourcing through an online platform is a real and unique and very useful solution.
Trulli says that since the coronavirus crisis began, they've seen a huge increase in participation. There's typically about 100,000 classifications a day across all the research projects worldwide. But by mid-March, the participation rate shot up by about a third. Each project has a forum where the research team and volunteers can chat with each other about the science, unusual objects they're seeing in the data, or just their lives in general.
It's been really heartwarming to see the role that citizen science can play right now in particular. I think we're all so keen to find ways to continue to engage and continue to have real impact.
We've definitely seen an uptick in citizen science since the quarantine has started.
Mark Cartwright is part of a research team from NYU and Ohio State University studying urban noise pollution. The project is called The Sounds of New York City. Citizen scientists are asked to listen to and then tag different city sounds. There's a list to choose from. Jackhammer, siren, car alarm, reverse beeping, street noise.
What citizen science gives us is scale, and that's really what we need in order to train reliable models for detecting these sources of noise pollution.
The project will also now look at how the quarantine is affecting noise in the city. For example, can their sensors detect changes from social distancing behaviors?
Do you see something special about this one?
A baby.
A baby! So we've got to put a green spot on it if it's a baby.
4-year-old Nina Schultz of Pittsburgh and her mom, Christy Gelling, are looking at photos of penguins collected by the research team behind Penguin Watch. It's one of the most popular citizen science projects with more than 8,000 volunteers.
How do we know it's a baby?
Because it's not black and white, it's gray.
Uh-huh.
And fluffy.
Yeah, and fluffy too.
Nina labeled and categorized a few dozen penguins, babies included, on this day, and her mom thinks they'll be back at it for many more to come.
This really is open to everyone.
Tom Hart is the Oxford researcher behind Penguin Watch. He says that the citizen scientists are a vital part of his project, and kids are especially good at it.
It's deliberately intuitive, but they'll see some penguins, they'll learn about stuff, but mostly they're just really, really helping us.
He just has one warning, is mildly addictive. For Here and Now, I'm Andy Daniel Cubis.
And we'll link you up at hereandnow.org. But in the meantime, what are you doing? What are you doing out there? You have ideas for parents trying to keep kids entertained. This sounded like a great one, but let us know others at hereandnow.org.
Some of the world's richest people are pledging huge sums of money to help combat the coronavirus pandemic. Twitter founder Jack Dorsey said last week that he would donate $1 billion to fund global COVID-19 relief. Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, and Tim Cook have also promised hundreds of millions of dollars in charitable donations related to the outbreak. And while their help may be welcomed in the midst of a global crisis, Recode senior reporter Teddy Schleifer writes, it also raises questions about the trade-offs we make when we depend on billionaires to save us. He joins us from San Francisco. Teddy, why do you say we should be skeptical of tech billionaires even when they seem to be doing good?
You know, I think it's kind of a bind that we find ourselves in. On the one hand, you know, if you're a nonprofit and you're being given the chance to get money from Jack Dorsey or Jeff Bezos or whomever, it seems ridiculous that someone would reject the money, right? On an individual level, a lot of these billionaires are actually genuinely doing good things. I think it would be hard to disagree. But in the aggregate, I think that's where the risk lies from activists that I've spoken with. The worry that this sort of philanthropy can sort of be a salve for a lot of the issues that we have in society when really it should be the government that's stepping up. And the concern is that the more we depend on these billionaires, the more power they accumulate, and that their philanthropy gives them power in the long run. Think about, for instance, the idea that, you know, there are suddenly a lot of nonprofits out there who could become dependent on the largesse of Jack Dorsey or Jeff Bezos or Mark Zuckerberg. And while the money is needed, I think the questions being raised are legitimate ones for society to reckon with.
Well, and especially when you're talking about somebody like Jeff Bezos and the company Amazon, which as all these small businesses around the country are having such a hard time making it through this economic crisis, a lot of people are turning to Amazon because they know it's still in business and can deliver things to them. They don't even have to go out to a store and put themselves at risk right now. And this is a way for him right. to make you feel good about that, I guess.
Right. I mean, I think a lot of people think about philanthropy and think about coverage of philanthropy almost like how the Red Sox should be covered. You know, more is good. The only things that matter are what happens on the field. Well, I sort of think of philanthropy as something more like politics. It's a system. And we can't just think about, you know, the charitable gifts in isolation from the way that these people run their businesses. There are two things that are part of the same pod, and you can definitely praise the philanthropic practices, but you should consider it alongside the system they live in and the system that they perpetuate as the leaders of these companies.
I imagine they're also getting some political influence by making these donations at a time when the White House is trying to get everybody to do everything they can to help.
Right. I mean, I think the example we talk about in our story is Larry Ellison, the founder of Oracle, one of the richest people in the world. And Larry Ellison, over the last couple of years, has really developed a particularly close relationship with the Trump administration. And Ellison reportedly has been one of the main people advising Trump to push for hydroxychloroquine, which is this unproven drug treatment for the coronavirus. And Ellison has been able to have that access to push Trump on this because he hosted a fundraiser for Trump earlier this year. You know, in any crisis, there's always an opportunity. And I think that tech leaders like Larry Ellison have seen an opportunity to kind of curry some influence with the administration, and some of them are deploying it right now.
That is Teddy Schleifer, senior reporter at Recode. Teddy, thank you.
You bet.
The coronavirus is creating enormous economic strain in the European Union. EU finance ministers finally reached a deal late last week on a $540 billion rescue package. It is not clear yet who will pay for it, pitting wealthier countries like Germany against poorer, harder-hit countries like Italy and Spain, and testing the solidarity of the EU. Joining us now from Paris is French philosopher and writer Bernard-Henri Lévy. Welcome. And the Italian prime minister has warned about failure of the European project. Do you agree with that? Is the European Union itself on the line here?
We are really edgy on this topic. On one side, yes, it's true that the European project could collapse. We see, for example, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban taking advantage of the virus in order to embrace a project which is absolutely not matching with the European values and so on. On the other hand, you cannot deny that the European Union is saving the European economics. Without European institution, we probably would be, at the moment I'm speaking, economically dead. And the European institutions have proved, on the contrary, to be alive and to be rather strong and to be able to react. The most efficient retaliation to the virus here came from the European institution. Madame Lagarde, who is now the head of the European Bank, she did the job.
But there is some hesitation on the part of the richer countries in Europe, including Germany, to be the bailout lender to the rest of Europe in this crisis. Do you see that? Do you think that some of the richer countries are going to be really skeptical about the idea of paying for everybody else?
There is hesitation. There is a debate. There is the old story of Germany unwilling. It was the same 5 years ago during the Greek crisis, unwilling to support the South and so on. But Germany has accepted sacrifices and has accepted some mechanisms of solidarity which are very opposite to its natural or customary habits and behavior.
What about economics aside? This crisis has made even states in the United States be a little worried about visitors from elsewhere. The state of Rhode Island started checking license plates from New York to tell people if they were coming in from another state that they had to quarantine for a period of time. What's happening in Europe with the borders? Is it still acceptable to go from one European country to another as it was?
It is still acceptable, but it is at stake. And this is not my least concern about this crisis. I'm concerned also with the way in which there is a sort of speed acceleration on processes which I don't like. For example, nationalism, petty nationalism, this is increasing. You have also some bad mud which is coming to the surface of the society. As always, when you have a plague, when you have a pandemic, you have some great acts of heroism, some great acts of bravery, but you have also the dark side of human nature, which is also appearing and coming up. And today, we have to fight, first of all, against the illness, but we have also to help the human bravery to prevail against this dark face which we often have. And I know that you have some people who would like every state in America to be sheltered, who would like in the Middle Age, you know, you had cities which were transformed into fortresses, you had the gated communities. Gated community is exists in America already for rich people in Texas and so on. It could become in all the world a sort of new pattern, and this would be really another nightmare. The medicine, the science, the bravery of the doctors will prevail, will overcome the pandemic. After that, we will have to be concerned at what is left, what comes after. The world of tomorrow could be worse than the world of yesterday. We could have a rise of xenophobia, a progress of gated communities, an increasing amounts of inequalities, social inequalities, and so on. It is true that the world of tomorrow will be different from the world of today, but it will sense, in the sense of the best or in the sense of the worst. We have to watch that very, very carefully.
What is your view of how the United States is handling the coronavirus crisis? It's now the country in the world with the most deaths so far.
Yes, and honestly, it is for someone like me and for all Europeans who love America, it's heartbreaking. And to see what is happening in New York, to see people not even being able to count and to bury properly their deaths, this is really something which breaks my heart. What I must say is that the civil society, as always, in the moments of big crisis in America, behaves bravely, with discipline and with courage. After that, you have in America, maybe more than in France, a debate on the evil and the remedy, what can be worse. You have to wonder, and this question is raised in the U.S., and it's right to raise the question, we have to think about how the cure could leave the world. If we have the first democracy in the world, the shining city upon the hill, collapsing, going back to the 30s with real push back on civil rights and so on because of the economic crisis, it would be really a disaster for the world. So today, to be honest, I pray for New York and I pray for America.
I want to ask you one more thing, Bernard Henri Lévy. When we speak to you often, we talk about other things, including the Kurds, which you've spent a lot of time focused on. How do you think that foreign policy is going to change, or are you concerned about any bad actors around the world trying to take advantage of this situation and that we need to be thinking about that right now?
I am concerned by that because on one side you have democracies for whom Americans, Europeans, every dead, every life is precious and every life is cherished. On the other side, you have other countries like Russia, like Turkey, or like China, who they don't care. They could not care less. And they are probably going to take advantage of this disaster to push their own advantage. And when I see China selling, by the way, not giving, selling masks to Europe and to America, of course it's a good thing, but I cannot prevent having a little uneasiness. When I see Putin bragging and pushing his forces in Iraq, in Syria, in the Middle East in general, in Ukraine, I cannot prevent myself from thinking that when we are completely busy, occupied, these bad guys, Putin, Xi Jinping, Erdogan, are taking advantage of this moment and of what they interpret as our weakness. It is not our weakness. It is our sophistication. It is our care of life. You tell me the Kurds. Today, the least we can say is that the Kurdish question is very, very far away in the list of the concerns of citizens of America and of Europe. And this is very bad, because the Kurds can be tomorrow, and especially the refugee camps, victims number ones of the coronavirus, of the COVID-19. And number two, when we wake up and when we are victorious of the virus, we might have a camp of ruins in this part of the world.
That is Bernard Henri Lévy, the French philosopher and writer, joining us from Paris. Thank you so much, as always.
Thank you, my dear. Thank you.
Maybe you are lucky enough to still have a job and to be able to do it from home and be safe. But do you appreciate your IT department more than ever? The thingy isn't working, the whatchamacallit won't turn on. Well, hold on. Brian Chen is here. He's lead consumer technology writer for the New York Times. He writes the Tech Fix column, and he's here to fix some of yours. Brian, welcome.
Hey, good to be here, Robin.
I have heard from a lot of colleagues. I'm still, you know, working at work, but I've heard from colleagues that, you know, there's that hashtag WFH, working from home. They say right. They have a whole different word for the F part. Are you hearing
exactly.
that?
Yeah, I'm definitely seeing a lot of internet memes of people struggling to work from home, and people are just comparing it to the apocalypse and trying to do work at the same time, and it's just not working out.
Yeah, and then when your technology fails, well, it definitely feels, you know, existential. So let's get to it. You say, first of all, don't try to get too many new gadgets or apps. Keep it simple. But let's get to the simplest, biggest problem that you hear about, Wi-Fi.
Yeah, the number one complaint I'm hearing from everybody so far is the internet. There's various reasons for why the internet is pretty bad when we work at home, right? There's one of the reasons could be that you probably haven't updated your Wi-Fi router in a long time. Like, a lot of people hold on to these routers for 5 to 10 years, and they're running older wireless standards that are not fast enough. They're causing a bottleneck for our smartphones and our computers when we try to do work. So that could be a culprit. The other potential culprit is that so many people are using things like video conferencing on Zoom or watching Netflix at the same time, and that's causing a huge spike in traffic for the internet providers, and a lot of people are getting slower internet as a result. So I think that's going to be the number one headache.
Okay, so let's take some of the issues one by one. Let's say your internet is strong in one room but weak in the one that you have to be in. You say get a mesh Wi-Fi system. Tell us about that.
Yeah, a mesh Wi-Fi system is a newer type of Wi-Fi technology where you basically have one main router, but you also have an extender, essentially. That's like a satellite hub, so there could be 2 or 3 or even 5 access points. And what they do is they build a continuous link of data connection throughout your home, depending on where you place these satellites. Like for me, I have a long hallway between my bedrooms and my living room where my router is, so I put a satellite hub inside my bedroom to extend that connection and get the rest of the house, you know, covered in Wi-Fi.
Yeah. Let's talk about the little things. And sometimes the things that are too little. And that's the laptop screen. So you've come home and now it's like, oh my God, I've got a laptop and it's just too small. It's funny. The day before Best Buy closed in the area I'm in, they had sold out of all laptops and computer screens, and people were buying small TVs to try to work at home. So what do you recommend if somebody's like, you know, this is, I'm realizing this is really uncomfortable, the screen's too small?
Yeah, I think for a lot of us, office workers are getting sent home with laptops by their corporations and their companies. And maybe they're used to working in an environment with a, you know, computer with multiple screens, and they're going to come home and work on a tiny screen, and that's going to be pretty challenging. So they could buy a larger monitor that they can attach to their laptop just to get some extra screen real estate. I would, you know, tell people to carefully consider whether or not they actually need more screen, though, because if you get too used to that and you get a really huge screen and you go back to work and you have a worse setup, it might be kind of painful to return one day.
Hopefully we'll someday return.
Yeah.
You talk about noise reducing headphones if you've got, you know, a lot of other people in the house with you. You talk about thinking about how you feel at your desk. Maybe you had a stand-up desk at work, or maybe your computer was raised. Make sure that you've considered those things. You know, get a mouse or a pad that, you know, can help with your wrists and all that kind of stuff, which, you know, it's important. But in the age of COVID-19, you have a job, right? You have a job and you're working from home. And that brings us to a tool that I call it a tool. You say have some empathy. Have empathy for your coworkers. Have empathy for people in the meetings you're in.
Right. Especially when it comes to using technology, have empathy for the fact that not everybody is going to be on the same level of sophistication when it comes to using technology. Not everybody has the same patience as people who want to use all these different tools. So I think what's important for a team is going to be that they all agree on a consistent set of tools that are easy to use, that everybody will use. What I'm seeing a lot in organizations is like one person wants to use one tool and another person wants to use a different tool, and they're asking each other to use each other's tools, and everybody's kind of competing and getting frustrated with each other. And one way to simplify is just like you have to like build a consensus and just agree upon a good set of tools.
And when you say tools, you mean Zoom versus Slack versus Google
Hangout?
Yeah.
Like any sort of like messaging or communication tool for teams. Like we really all need to be on board and just be on the same team, essentially.
Brian Chen, lead consumer technology writer for the New York Times. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
So, Jeremy, you've been working at home. I'm hoping to head there soon. I am so afraid I'm going to want to, you know, wash the floors, rearrange my sock drawer.
Yep. I've done all those things. And by the way, the mesh network idea, I have that. It's very good. And the second monitor, about a month ago when I moved to working from home, I got a second monitor, and I must say it makes a huge difference.
Did you get one of those lights that you're supposed to put in front of you so you look good on the Zoom meeting?
No, I did not. You tell me.
I'm getting one. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.